Everybody, delighted that you're here. And we're going to continue our engagement with the Enlightenment book from the Cabours manuscript and the derivative work that came out of that. I basically started into explaining how these first couple of chapters of the book, The End of Suffering, came about as a result of my interaction with the Enlightenment book and working with that. So this was part of the extension of that, and yesterday we talked about the idea of the overcoming life and how dealing with the internal dynamics of an individual's mind is something that is highly resisted. And therefore, though it was the core instruction of Yeshua, it became pretty much left behind, untried, and that a substitution of belief took place for the effort of doing one's inner work. So we're going to move on from there, but first I'll check with Jenny and see if we have any questions. Sweetie, do we have any questions in the email or anything happening in the chat room or anybody with a hand up in the phone queue?
There are no hands up and nothing. Oh, a hand just went up. But I was just going to say the only email that I got was the one that I gave you a copy of to Sean, and it's really detailed, so I don't know that we, you know, want, and he said we didn't have to address it on the radio show.
Right.
But I'll just say, Sean, if you're listening, you can't figure it out, and I think that's what you're trying to do.
The number one pseudo-solution of the non-being mind is if I could just figure this out. And, you know, there is an intellectual component to the journey, no question. But the objective of the intellectual journey is not to arrive at an understanding of the bottom line truth. The objective of the intellectual journey is, number one, intellect's questions out of the way so that our thing will shut up. You know, you've got to be out of your mind to heal. And two, to answer the questions of the intellect so it will quiet down. And then we can give instructions. So we're never going to get the truth out of the mind, but we can give it instructions, and then it will support us and prompt us to follow those instructions so we can come into an experience of what this work is really about. So that would be the bottom line for me. Figuring it out is the booby prize. Doing the work is the objective.
And we do have a hand up. It's area code 610. I believe it's Miss Susan.
Yes, it is again. Yeah.
Welcome, young lady.
Didn't take too long. Hey, this is just a report. Tim and I were in this snowstorm, or our whole area was in a snowstorm, and we lost electricity 2 days ago. And
ouch.
I'm glad you said that, because, you know, here we are. We were cold. We couldn't warm anything up because our stove is an electric stove, and I couldn't do any of my work. A lot of it is on the computer now. I'm editing a piece, and I can hand edit on pieces of paper, which I do, but I get to a point where I've got to put those onto the computer, and so that wasn't happening.
Sure.
And we have Michael here, who has been homeless, as you know, and he had severe anxiety, and he hasn't been well anyway. He's been sick with some mysterious, he calls it irritable bowel syndrome, very upset gastric situation.
Mm.
And I found Tim Bingham, we were saying to each other, isn't it amazing? We have a house, we have warm clothes, we can build a fire, we're okay, and we are so incredibly affected by this nuisance. It was a very hard thing to get through, and I thought, boy, this is embarrassing. I was thinking about all, you know, Ukraine and Gaza and the Holocaust. I thought, I have not appreciated how much suffering, how much destabilization, uncertainty, physical discomfort, hunger. We couldn't cook anything, so we went to a diner. Well, who gets to do that in Gaza? And so
right.
I'm just telling you that it just blew my mind how spoiled, privileged, how easily knocked off center Tim and I were. And as soon as the heat came on last night, we were dancing around saying, hey, and
I can understand that.
You can't, but it's just a report of kind of mea culpa. Yike. I have, I don't know what to say about this, except it was a learning experience. That's what it was.
Realizing how privileged we are?
Yeah. More than I knew.
I'm with you. Absolutely. You know, being able to flip a little switch and have a place that's warm, that's like monumental when you think of the history of humanity and what people have lived through. Definitely, for me, it goes far beyond gratitude into just deep appreciation for what we have, for sure.
Yeah.
So joining you in that appreciation.
Okay, good. Have you been able, I shouldn't ask you, I should give a report. I'm doing my Lenten practice. I started it this morning, read a 4-page letter that my mother had addressed to my oldest sister, and then asked if that sister would send it to the other siblings. And she put check boxes. And so I was the last recipient. So I got to keep the letter. And the thing I'm noticing is, having made the decision to read her letters feels really, really good, even though this particular letter was just newsiness, you know, what Daddy was doing, and they had just moved to Florida and how happy they were there, and they're planting tomatoes, and nothing, no big emotional reports or anything. It was just a happy woman chattering to her kids. And so that's my first report. All is well so far. And
it sounds like getting into closer proximity and your relationship with her is becoming more comfortable, and that was the objective of the mind shifter you've been working on.
Yes. Yep. Very much so. So anyway.
Sweet.
Okay. Thanks. I can sign off and let you carry on.
All right. Have a blessed one. Holding the space.
Thanks. You too.
All right.
There are no other hands up, so go for it.
Well, then let's go with it. So again, the last paragraph that I read yesterday, I taught the possible. Yeshua speaking. I taught the possible. The overcoming life, and because of its difficulty, it's been left untried. Instead, substituting belief for effort in the inner work I demonstrated and instructed people to do. In one case, several of my disciples, when instructed in the work required to heal, left muttering, "Too hard a saying." Now, they never returned. I instructed people in the art and science of undoing the false self, of refraining from the habits, behaviors, addictions, and sensations that accompany, quote-unquote, living in that state of mind. I even informed them that the result would be a sort of death, saying that in order for you to live, you've got to die. It takes no effort to live in your natural state of love, unless you've lost your true identity. Having been focused on the outer world since birth, must learn to go within and expend the effort to do the work of forgiving the dynamics of the false self, the self fabricated by the mind. Freeing oneself from the thought disorders that constitute this self, Yeshua referred to when he said, in order for you to live, you must die. That becomes the objective of one's inner work. The mind is a tricky thing. Those who refuse to expend the effort to do the inner work I taught would rather engage in the ruse that they can just shout my name and believe I will clean up their lives for them. thinking that belief in me is all it takes. They concocted elaborate rituals in the hope that they can avoid the gut-level work of self-transformation. That work which I taught. To them I said, many will say to me in that day, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name? And in thy name have we cast out devils? And in thy name done many wonderful works? And then I will profess to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you that work iniquity. In other words, if you're functioning out of hostility and fear, you ain't been doing what I've been telling you to do. Therefore, whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them, I will liken to a wise man. I came to make you a wise person, not to promote the idea that you are a helpless sinner. I explained to those refusing to put their hand to the plow and do the work I recommended, not everyone that says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into community of love, but those which do the will of the Creator. Entering the quote-unquote kingdom of heaven was not about some afterlife belief in a paradise, but properly understood in my native Aramaic was about living today in the state of love, the state of original being, which results in living in a community of love, which is the Aramaic meaning of heaven. Those who did not adopt my work, those that cried too hard a saying, pretended, but they didn't know me at all. They used my name, but continued in their old fear and hostility-based generational abuses, pretending to be under my cloak. No one whose language is still based in fear, threat, condemnation, and hostility is in alignment with the will of the Creator, love. One trapped in that mindset has much work to do to overcome that insanity instilled through fear-based language. Do you mean that John 14:6, you were quoted inaccurately when it says, I am the way, the truth, and the life? No one comes to the Father except through me? No, that quote is absolutely accurate. However, you must recall, I said it's important to hear my meanings in their original Aramaic context. Being so used to thinking I knew his teachings, I had to reach back to the earlier part of our conversation, which though it was just minutes ago seemed like hours. I recalled him saying it was Aramaic, but did not really grasp his statement about the Aramaic meanings of his words. Finally, I managed to answer, yes, I recall, but does that mean the translations were wrong? This may sound strange, but especially from my native Aramaic, you can have what seems to be a perfect translation and not have a clue what I meant. My language is rife with idioms that are not translatable, even by the best of translators. You must know the meanings of my idioms to have a clue about my instructions and results promised. Notice, my focus is on doing the inner work, not shouting my name and thinking all is well, an invention of the mind that does not grasp what I taught. The mind that does not understand inner work, the challenging work of facing and changing one's deepest non-being self, the inner meaning of my teaching, that one always wants a guru to follow, someone to do it for them. It was no different 2,000 years ago when I said to them, I have come in my Father's name, and you do not accept me. But if someone else comes in their own name, you'll accept them. It's not about me. It's about removing the inner blocks to relationship with our Creator, love. How much plainer can I say it? Others will want you to accept their interpretation of my words, but I ask you to listen to me and let my words speak for themselves. With my training, this was almost more than my nervous system could handle. I was dumbstruck. I finally managed to mutter, I'll have to breathe a while to get through those thoughts. My true teachings liberate people them into direct relationship with love instead of making them cower in fear of God, of the Creator. Remember, God is love. Fear has no place in any true relationship with the Creator. And I gave people the protocol for doing that. I replied, I do not understand about this protocol. He replied, my words about the protocol are the most important words that I, or anyone for that matter, have ever spoken. Told them how to read the scriptures. I gave them the key, but it has not been understood, or it was covered up and ignored. How long will they, in my name, go on pretending to teach what I taught by promoting fear instead of love? How long will people fall for being manipulated through purposely instilled fear by those who've instilled that fear to keep them under control? I intended to free people from fear by teaching them the power of love. I was somewhat confused. His words delivered thought that seemed to me were condemning, yet his voice was filled with compassion. I knew that I had been the one speaking those words. It would have been out of extreme frustration and anger. But there was no judgment. He just offered helpful, true information while maintaining serenity and peace. He was speaking as though he was reporting the news, no attachment. I wondered, is this what holding to the first law, keeping the condition of love in the mind while confronting inappropriate behavior, looks like? Be sure, he said, the person you stand before actually understands my teachings and methods before you accept their word that what they say has anything to do with me. A simple test to determine the veracity of someone who says they represent me is that, as a result of practicing what they teach you, you will experience an increased ability to hold a space of love in your mind no matter what happens in your life. There is a game as old as time, and I pointed out 2,000 years ago when I quoted Isaiah. This people honoreth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men. It was my words, my teaching, and my example that were important, not me. But didn't you say I am the way? Yes, he replied. I also said, howbeit in vain do they worship me, once again, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men. For laying aside the commandments of love, ye hold to the tradition of men. In the past 2,000 years, millions have done the same thing in my name that unreformed reformers have done since time immemorial. They focused on me, parroting what I said, but ignoring my instructions. And they didn't even know it. Again, Elias prophesied of this generation. He prophesied of hypocrites and said, this people honoreth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. So what you find in the Aramaic is that the objective is to bring the heart, which in our modern updated language would be the unconscious, into alignment with what our words are saying and what's going on in our heads. Not a set of words going on in the head, but behaviors coming from the heart. You remember Yeshua said, you take care of the heart, for out of it are the issues in life, and you must forgive from your heart. It doesn't mean it's not a bleeding heart statement, forgive from your heart. It's saying you must remove content from your own unconscious that's out of alignment with the words you speak. He goes on to say, I corrected the errors of my forebears, errors that have been taught as scripture and presented as the word of God. But if it's written in the Bible, I replied, it is the word of God, I retorted. Well, there are those who would like you to believe that, but notice I brought corrections. If corrections were needed, obviously what I corrected must have been an error. That's just too much for my mind to handle. The world I was born into calls that blasphemy. Yes, he said, and so did the world that I was born into, and that's one of the reasons they killed me. I challenged the established orders, the beliefs, and the power structures of my day by bringing truth. I confronted their errors, and they had to get rid of me because my ideas were gaining wide acceptance and would have led to a loss of their power. To confront a person's, or worse yet, a power structure's errors is to elevate the stress of each individual involved. Most humans travel the lower path, and one of the behaviors common to that mode of living is that when stress goes up, the one experiencing the elevated stress looks outside themselves to remove the stimulus for the stress. For most, there is no interest in dealing with the cause of the stresses, which are always internal. I replied to him, I get the sense you just said something very important, but I'm not sure I understand what it was. I breathed. His words seared my mind like a hot poker. In my name, fear, terror, threats, religious abuse, condemnation and discrimination, guilt, fear, suffering, blood sacrifice, punishment, religious wars, crusades, inquisitions, witch burnings, and torture. They're all the very behaviors I came to halt. They're all behaviors that come from the insane human mind. And mark my words, anyone who does any of the above is insane. But you've just included the majority of the world's population in your definition of insanity. Yes, and rightly so. I came to restore sanity to a world gone mad. I came to instruct humanity how to shift from a fear-based mind, the mind of the world, to a love-based mind, the mind of the Creator. You were told in the scriptures that I said, have rachma for your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you. And pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. But wrapped as they were in the commandments of men, they could not hear my instructions. It's time for my words to be heeded. I presented an ethic to the world and demonstrated living that ethic in the face of overwhelming abuse and torture. And people promoted the idea that I came to teach the acceptance of abuse and suffering as a holy thing. I came to teach the power of staying connected to the presence of love in you and removing everything that conflicted against that. Living my ethic, not shouting my name, is how to profess and prove belief in me. You accept me when you live as I instructed, not live in the same old conditions, using the same old language, playing out the same hostilities, or shouting my name. Over the course of the last two millennia, distortions occurred in the interpretation of my work and teaching. Twisted and reversed much of what I meant. Let me unfold for you an understanding of the developments that has people in my name violating virtually everything I said. His voice was filled with compassion, and he seemed committed to telling a story that needed to be told. There was a deep clarity and power in his words. He'd been told that on the cross I said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Words that I never spoke. Those words were put into my mouth by people who did not understand what happened in the days surrounding my death. They either had no comprehension of the power and import of my words, or had no interest in representing the truth of what I said. My actual words, Eli, Eli, Lama Sabachthani, four of the final words I uttered from the cross, are the few words in the Western construction of the scriptures that appears they fell from my lips, untranslated. Those words, spoken in my native Semitic tongue, Aramaic, accurately conveyed my state of mind. When the Greeks got through with their misinterpretation, I had been anything but accurately represented. Contrary to the traditional understanding of those words, I did not speak out of victimhood, but celebration. My disciples, those who conveyed the stories that had become your scriptures, did not understand. Throughout my healing at Gethsemane, my trial and the crucifixion, they were lost, unconscious in the mind of fear, which induces a kind of stupor, somewhat like an anesthetic, which stifles the higher faculties. Literally, living in fear is called sympathetic dominance, and it shunts blood away from the frontal lobes of the brain, where Rachma is located. I was tutoring them on how to enter a new mind, the mind I used, but due to their unforgiven fears and hostilities, they could not hold to it. Had they been able to think in terms other than their human minds, they would have understood. But the adversary, fear, had such a grip on them, they could not. Recall in the garden, I found the disciples asleep, unconscious. And I said, Peter, Simon, sleepest thou? Could thou not watch 1 hour? My explanation of the problem? The spirit is truly ready, but the flesh is weak. Anyone who has actually embarked on the work I taught will recognize Peter's challenge because they themselves have been through the ordeal of not being able to follow their higher guidance, commitments, and aspirations when stressed. Many want to travel the path they had laid out, but they are too engrossed in the adversary. The mind of the body with its past, its generational pains, fears, rages, blocks, frustrations, and vengeances. Each must bear the task of working through their own past, of getting beyond their history. I did not bring a belief system to be believed, but a body of work to be done. My life was a call to do that, for each to take up their cross, not mine. Few recognize that I was teaching the tools with which to do that inner work, to overcome the body's mind, and even fewer practice the use of those tools. I lived my own teaching. Unbeknownst to my disciples, facing death and conquering it by holding to the mind of love, the mind of the Creator, was my process in Gethsemane and beyond. I challenged the world mind so deeply they killed me. Some think I was martyred, but I lived through death, an accomplishment inconceivable for the world mind. Each of my martyred disciples died. Lacking the ability to produce the result I did, do you think they actually possessed the capacity to accurately explain my teachings and achievement? Do you suppose they could teach how to accomplish stepping into eternal life? They misread my deepest teachings. What other explanation is there for their behaviors? So great was his lack of understanding that Peter even used his sword to try to stop my process, to prevent the accomplishment of the very purpose for which I came. I was here to open the gateway to the overcoming of death for all. And to him I said, get thee behind me, Satan. Thou art an offense unto me, for thou savorest or honor not the things that be of the Creator, but those that be of men. Satan, Satani in my native Aramaic, simply means the resistor, the adversary, one who misleads. Peter was adversarial to and resisted the plan that I was playing out because he was attached to the output of his own fear-based mind. He loved, quote-unquote, not the things that be of the Creator, but those that be of men. As he took a breath, I broke in and said, I know who Satan is. I've spent years in scriptural study and know that Satan is a dark fallen angel that disobeyed God. He holds such horror and never grasped why you insulted Peter by calling him that. Yes, she replied, I understand your culture's idea of Satan. It's part of how you're kept in fear. Once again, your beliefs about Satan lock you into the things, quote, that be of men, and that's why you're not hearing me. I just clearly defined for you my meaning for Satan, and yet you slid right over it and inserted your own definition, though I quite clearly was saying something else. It's an important piece of work to be able to catch your mind when it does this. For those who are adversaries to my work and purpose will take advantage of that tendency in you. Honoring the things that be of the Creator, those based in love, more than those based in the minds of men, fear and hostility, is the solution to that problem. In short, you must learn to honor yourself as love more than you fear fear, and more than you trust your anger to protect you. Humanity, for eons, has been trained in fear, and it is difficult for a fear-based mind to elevate love above its God, fear. I came to train humans to function first out of love, but they had difficulty and even understanding because they were listening to me through a screen, actually quite literally a filter of fear. The human mind, programmed through fear, resists change and is the main adversary to truth. At this moment, as I often pointed out to my students in the scriptures, you cannot hear my word. Notice when this happens, you only hear what's going on in your own head. You think you're hearing me and understanding my words, but that grotesque personification of all that is evil, the definition held in your mind from your past, is not what I called Peter. That would be a grave insult, a terrible thing to call anyone, let alone one of my beloved disciples. Aramaic peoples would never do that to a friend. Are you prepared to consider that I meant something different than that beast you've been taught exists, Peter, and called him Satan? I replied, I always thought it was unkind for you to have called him that, so it makes sense that you meant something different. I'm a little confused, though, and need help in getting clear on what you're saying. Confusion is a natural part of undoing serious misperceptions, especially if there are emotions attached to them. Get used to it if you're going to engage in the work I taught. It is a part of becoming free, of cleaning up and clearing out of your mind those things that be of men. This is a major piece of work that each must now do. Each who, through fear, has had fear preached to them in my name. There's a great deal of false teaching to be forgiven if you're ever going to have a mind that can actually represent me. Developing ability to think in Aramaic meaning so that you can understand my words as I meant them is no small feat. When in my name you've been steeped in Greek philosophy. my teachings and all of your Western theology has been filtered through and powerfully influenced by Greek minds choked on horrific images of gods and devils. I cannot overemphasize the importance of shaking yourself free of all of that and adopting my Aramaic meanings and mindset. The human mind and its thought system is like a container blocking entrance to that which does not fit into it and adding its own content to that which does. Greek thought as a container is a well-developed example of materialist thinking, quote-unquote thinking, an example of what the scriptures refer to as the mind of men. Time I, in my native Aramaic, taught a previously unknown understanding of life, of the Creator, and of the pathways to living inside the laws of the Creator. This form of thinking had pervaded much of the world and dominated Western thought. The filtering of my teachings through Greek translations add much that was not in my mind and blocks the understanding of a significant portion of what I taught, having the effect of shutting people's minds to what I did teach. For instance, many use my name and preach a wrathful, vengeful, punishing God. Instead of them, listen to my words. When I spoke of the Creator, my mind was not filled with the punitive Greek pantheon that was forced on you in Greek philosophy and passed on to you as having come from me. I spoke of the Creator as Spirit, whose kingdom is within you, who knoweth what things you have need of before you ask, whose good pleasure it is to give you the kingdom, and who is kind even to the unthankful and to the evil. Find me men that live that today. It is the Creator's nature to bless, and anything less is impossible. Hellfire is man's fantasy, made up to keep others out of the mind of love by locking them into fear. When I spoke of Satan, I did not have beastly images of Greek terror in mind. If you want to be able to accomplish what I did, you must remove those images. You must align every part of yourself with love. Just listen to and understand my words. Understand them as I meant them. Greek thought was very materially and intellectually oriented and never matured spiritually into a mindset that could contain or even comprehend my teachings. Greek philosophy is an example of the highly developed trickery of the mind of man, the mind of perception, which has, due to its limited nature, watered down everything I taught. If you listen to my words, they tell you quite a different story. They tell you exactly what I meant. For example, judge not, and you shall not be judged. Condemn not, and you shall not be condemned. Notice the criteria was the behavior, not acceptance of me. Judge not, condemn not. Forgive, and forgiveness will occur for you. And my response was, but what about judgment? His reply, there is judgment, yes. And I explained it when I said, by whatever measure you measure, it will be measured unto you. not the judgment condemnation that Greek mythology brings to my words, but in a sense of bringing you what you asked for. I know something that you and the Greek scholars do not know. Could they write down or translate what they did not understand and had not experienced? When you find one that can hold the space of love for their killers, perhaps you will have found one who knows. Until then, learn what I said in its original form, and you will grow the understanding that will show you how to accomplish what I did. To understand me, best you listen to what I have to say, rather than being trapped in what was planted in your mind by those who did not understand or had motives other than to represent me accurately. Simply look, without the prejudice of your past, at my words. I did not address Peter as a beastly personification of evil. In my statement to Peter, who was a resistor to the Creator's mind and an adversary to my purpose, I defined what I meant by Satan. Wait a minute, I'm still a little confused. I'm not quite taking in what you mean. He replied, once more, listen to what I said to Peter. For thou savorest not the things that be of God, but those that be of men. I replied, what's that got to do with our discussion? We were talking about Satan. He replied, yes, Satan. Remember I spoke of two possible minds for a human to think of, or pardon me, to think with? One is the fabricated, poverty, fear, and hostility-based mind of perception, the adversary, Satan. The other is the mind of love. That's almost more than I can think about. Listen to my words. My definition of Satan is in those words. Nothing to do with that horrific demon that the Greeks implanted in your mind. My words speak for themselves. Recall, Satana in Aramaic is the resistor or adversary. The Creator's mind is the mind of love, and love is always present if the mind of God is active in you. Nothing religious about that, just the fact of active present love in you. The other mind is a pretender. Only one is real. Cannot listen to two minds. You cannot serve two masters. You cannot serve the Creator and the mind of the body or mammon. Peter attempted to serve the Creator with a fear-based mind, the mind of his body, mammon in my words, and rendered himself unable to see the true purpose of my situation. Entangled as he was in the things that be of men, he thought he was being protective, but was trapped quite literally in Satan, the adversary, his fear-based mind, and I told him so. A mind governed by the laws of fear with its resistance to loving perceptions blocks truth and therefore distorts whatever it sees. Awareness of what is true is blocked because fear pushes love's mind, the mind of the Creator, away. Trapped in the pretender, the mind of the body, of man, he was judging the situation out of his past, therefore, or savoring the things that be of men. That fear mind was his adversary and prevented him from savoring the things that be of God. That is, prevented him from understanding what was available and understandable only through the mind of love. He went on to admit, at first I was even in fear about this plan. At Gethsemane, before I understood fully, I said, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. As I healed my fear that day, I began to fully grasp the Creator's plan for me, but Peter did not. Locked as he was into his fabricated, fear-based mind, Satan in my language, he could not hear the promptings from God that would have shown him what was really happening. Had he been truly savoring the things that be of the Creator, he would not have been place of resistance. He would have seen that this plan was based in love and was not about suffering, sacrifice, and victimhood, but a demonstration, something that was impossible for him to comprehend. Notice there are those today who yet promote the value of suffering, sacrifice. If Peter had gotten his way, resistant as he was to the truth of the situation, who would have led me away from my mission, did me from being held up as a demonstration to all of humanity that the Creator did not create us for death, and death could actually be overcome. He therefore met my culture's definition of Satan, the resistor, and would have misled me even if I had not been aware. Recall, I made Satan, quote-unquote, mind of man, my footstool, my servant, not my God. To understand me, you must do the same. I taught my disciples a form of forgiveness foreign to your culture. In my native Aramaic, forgiveness is a way to remove unwanted conditions from the mind. It is not about letting others off the hook because that undesirable condition is active in you. Had Peter been conscious enough to apply what I taught him, instead of trying to stop my process, he would have weakened fear's grip on him by applying forgiveness. By doing so, his mind would have been free of the adversary fear and available to my purpose. He would have cast out fear, as I taught, by the presence of perfect love, and then would have actually supported me by holding fast to that love, which is what I'd been teaching him and each of my disciples. So grave was Peter's lack of understanding that when asked if he was one of my followers, he denied me and began to curse and swear, saying, "I do not know this man of whom you speak." The rest of my disciples, trapped as they were in the adversary fear, forsook me and fled. They were quite literally trapped in Satan. Fit from the mind of love, the mind I'd been training my disciples for, they did not understand what I set up and what I had consciously consented to participate in by being tortured and crucified. Contrary to all their fears, I knew at the moment of my impending death that death no longer had a hold over me, a truth beyond the grasp of anyone functioning out of the body's mind. I had done my work. No one was aware that I had ended suffering in the Garden of Gethsemane. I had overcome death and suffering, and by so doing, opened the door for humanity, when willing, to do the same. Notice how I treated people, even my enemies. That is what doing the will of my Father entails. My victory over suffering and death was such a quantum leap beyond the world mind, the mind that kills us, that no one, including my disciples, could even relate, let alone understand. What I did was so far beyond the beliefs of a humanity steeped in suffering and death that it had to be diluted, obviously, even by the students I'd been personally training. What I'm about to unfold may sound like science fiction, but it is science fact. Lacking comprehension of my mission and the purpose of my work, suffice to say, no one understood what I accomplished that day. My head reeled. Everything in me balked at these ideas. Do I dare engage these thoughts? My breath evaporated as his statements transformed themselves into questions in my mind. No one understood? Watered down? That can't be. I began to grasp the authorities who use fear and force are simply insecure in their knowledge and have lost contact with the presence of love that was their true state. I was astounded. I had studied and listened to Yeshua's every word. I'd followed the directives of the Greek experts, the people who knew. I thought, I've looked in all the right places, the church, the scriptures. I've read the writings of the best theologians I could identify. I knew more than I needed to know about dogma. It had been drummed into my head since childhood. I thought, why was I never offered this knowledge? Then I took for me what was an extremely difficult step. Though I was in shock, I began to admit for the first time that much of the dogma I believed, I had accepted because of fear. Intimidated by those in charge into believing that his teachings were expressed fully in the Greek writings, I did not allow myself a conflicting thought. I dared not clash with the scholars and preachers whose silent contempt and arrogance I bought into, and by so doing it forced the life out of any real questioning I might have engaged in. Now, with just a few words direct from Yeshua, I started to develop the ability to see from his perspective. For the first time in my life, I allowed myself something I had been absolutely forbidden. I began to concede that somewhere inside me I knew something was not right. An inner knowing I dared not acknowledge previously told me there were important pieces missing, and finally the light was dawning. I had always been confused by my own inability to live up to what I saw as Yeshua's example. Even more disconcerting were some of the actions of religious leaders I observed. They preached Yeshua's words of love, but counseled and did violence. I had watched their verbal violence toward children and wondered how they could recommend war. Chrissy, the guilt trips, the raging sermons, the hostility and fear had always shaken my core and seemed inconsistent with Yeshua's message of love. I began to trust the wisdom I was born with. For intuitively, I always knew that life was about something different than all the hostility and fear of the world, preachers included. I could now see and was finally beginning to understand. In the past, I had indicted myself and the hypocrites for our quote-unquote sins. I was starting to see that we've all been born and bred in a world of hostility, punishment, and fear, and therefore unknowingly had been conformed to this world. Suddenly it was obvious that people did not choose the negative pathway. It was just the way of the world to take over and mold people's minds unless they were aware. What was needed was a space of love for healing, a space where on a very practical level we could be transformed by the renewing of the mind, and learn to live in this mind, which was also the mind of Yeshua. I was beginning to grasp that he came to teach us to weaken fear, hostility, and its accompanying behaviors through forgiveness and love, thereby developing the ability to think and live out of a mind of love, which is literally the mind of the Creator. It was as though a bright light shone in the dark, the dingy corners of my mind. So a person in error is in need of someone who can presence love, the mind of God, I exploded with excitement. Yes, you explained that the original idea of priesthood was to do exactly that. I came to bring tools that empowered people in the experience of love, not the theological wrangling that today passes as my work. It was the job of the priest to have done his or her own inner work to the point that no matter what that priest faced, no matter what another was going through, they could hold and actively presence love, the mind of Christ, and therefore facilitate healing, he explained. The world mind, the adversary, thinks it's being helpful when it judges and condemns. In its righteousness and pretense at knowing, it punishes and condemns, and by doing so just adds error to error, dragging down the person it purports to correct. Yeshua spoke up. Recall, I said, neither do I condemn thee. Suffice to say, the mind that condemns has not done its own work, and is appropriately described by Paul when he says, therefore, thou art inexcusable, O man, whoever you are that judgest, for wherein thou judgest another, thou condemnest thyself, for thou dost the same things. Humanity is not in need of more judgment, especially from one thinking they represent me. For one who condemns is simply caught in an error corresponding to the error of the person they condemn. It is time for humanity to get the truth. I came to deliver the tools for each individual to manifest the love of God in their lives and the lives of those who could not do it for themselves, whatever their error. Clearly, I did not come to deliver reasons for war, separation, dogma, condemnation, and fault-finding. I said, and if any man hear my words and believe not, I judge him not, for I came not to judge the world, but to save the world. Read my lips. No judgment. I came to save the world mind from its own insanity, and it's carried on with all its old conflicts, family squabbles, wars, and reasons for separation and religious condemnation as though I had never spoken. The killing, psychological, emotional, and physical, has continued as if I demonstrated nothing, only now it's often done in my name. Your world is in danger of self-destruction, much of it over theological conflict and debate. It is time for the insanity done in the name of the Creator, love, to end, and for the work I demonstrated to actually be carried out. It's time for a suffering humanity to experience the active presence of the love of God, whoever they are, whatever their form of suffering. Condemnation, study, debate, and war will not bring healing, but the active presence of love will. My heart opened and tears began to flow as I could feel old trauma melting away. In that same instant, without conscious prompting from me, my mind shifted to excitement. Could it be, after all these years of study, I'm beginning to